All right, I got about 30 minutes.
Okay.
I'm doing Michael Potluck after you. You know him in the club, Michael Potluck?
Yep, I recognize his name, and I think I've interacted with him some.
Awesome. All right, so this is, David, this is the first one of these special interests that I've done. And Matt's doing them, and I'm doing this. This is just kind of fun. So I want to just keep it lighthearted, kind of fun, talk about, you wrote a little bit in here. And so I'm looking at my notes here. Now, one of the things I wanted to start with, I think is really cool. You were named after Lin-Manuel Miranda's Hamilton, right? Isn't that what your parents, is that why your parents named you David Hamilton?
Yeah, I'm sure. I'm sure that's the story that I've heard.
That, I mean, that's what I always thought. And the other thing I want to talk about is before we get into your stuff, I want to get into my stuff. You and I look like famous celebrities, right?
Yeah, we get that a lot.
What's yours? Everybody, I mean, for the people that aren't able to see you.
Gene Hackman.
Gene Hackman, exactly. I'm Robert Duvall.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly the same.
No, you look like Paul Rudd, right? Do you get
that? Like, I get that daily. And I was a dick about it at one point. Just because it was so like regularly, and I had that realization of like, hey, like this person doesn't know that I literally hear that every day, so I gotta be a little nicer about it. So now I just have fun with it. So always fun. You can see when I walk in and somebody's eyes light up and they're like, hey, and they're always like, hey, does, and it's yes, I hear it every day. Yeah, I know exactly what you're gonna say. Yes, Paul Rudd. Yep, I'm familiar.
Have you ever faked it and like signed an autograph or anything?
No, but the closest I ever got to faking it was one time we were in New Orleans. We were driving around trying to find a place to park down by the by Jackson Square. Yeah. And this guy at a hotel was like, hey, has anybody ever told you you look like Paul Rudd? And I was like, yeah, I hear that all the time. He's like, well, are you? And I was like, and if I say yes, he might let me park in here and I'll have to pay for it. that's it.
Yep. Then you would have been screwed.
Yeah. Right. Well, yeah. I mean, there's a whole lot of stuff on that. It's like, this could work out, but also it's a federal crime.
Right.
I prefer to avoid felonies as much as I can.
Right. Mine has always been Jason Bateman ever since I was in high school. He had what was the name of the show? It was like Valerie or something like that. And he was like a big teen star for a while. So when I was in high school, people said I looked like him. And then he disappeared. And then he came back and got mega famous. He's like one of the, mm-hmm. There's a few weird actors like that, that like you think their career is over and all of a sudden they come back strong, like him, probably John Travolta. You know, like it was nothing. He was doing like Look Who's Talking 7 or something like that with the babies. And then all of a sudden he's in Pulp Fiction and, you know, he's a massive star again. So that's kind of crazy. But I don't ever get now, obviously, no one ever thinks, hey, Jason Bateman, I've gotten too big and old for that now.
Well, it started for me in 2017 or 2007, like at the end of college is when I really started to get it. I got other celebrities before that, like Cameron from Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Oh, yeah.
Stuff like that. I actually dressed as him for Halloween one year because of that. but it started there. But it was always like, hey, you look like that guy. And then because he had gone away for a little bit. And then as he got more and more popular, it's like been whatever he's in. Now it's Ant-Man. Everybody says, hey, everybody, you look like Ant-Man.
Right.
And some hoping Ghostbusters, you know, that's good for him so that I can carry that on a little bit. Maybe it'll be something different.
All right. So I'm looking at my notes here. And you said that you want to talk about bourbon, house church, and music. And so which one do you want to start with?
I mean, I'm a big fan of bourbon, but I'll talk about all of those and I can talk about all of them for a while. So
well, let's see.
You tell me what you want to talk about.
Let's see how big of a fan you are of bourbon, my friend. I looked at the best bourbon brands of 2020. This comes from lux.digital.com. And I want to see, do you think you can guess any in the top 15?
Top 15. Is it the brands or by sales?
Yeah, brands. Well, it might be by, well, this is just their, so like the first one, like best bourbon on a budget, best value bourbon.
Oh, okay.
Best bourbon.
I could probably guess some of those.
All right.
Probably.
Give it a guess. What do you think the best budget bourbon is?
If I were to, I'm guessing mine is Evan Williams Bottled and Bond.
Bingo. You nailed it. Wow, Evan Williams, number one best budget bourbon.
Yeah, the Bottled and Bond is cheap. It's like $20, and it's 4 year aged bourbon, so it's gonna have a decent flavor to it. And it like think of Bottled and Bond as like the German purity law for beer, where it's like you can only use certain ingredients. Like there, you can only make it a certain way if you're doing it bonded bourbon. If you want it to be bonded, it has to be made a certain way. So, it's good taste and super cheap.
I just thought it was cheap. Yeah, I thought it was cheap. What do you think?
Well, most of it is, but that one's good. That one just happens to be good.
This one's kind of, I think this is a little tricky. It was the best bourbon under $50, but I mean, you could have said Evan Williams there, but what do you think? Like this one, because I mean.
I'm trying to think of under $50. For me, if I were guessing at $50, it's Wild Turkey Rare Breed.
There's his Four Roses.
Four, what does it say specifically which one? Small batch or just say Four Roses?
Four Roses. No, yeah, it just says whatever. It doesn't.
Oh, okay.
Single barrel Four Roses. Yeah.
I'm not a big Four Roses fan overall, but they do have a unique thing. They have 10 different recipes that they follow with different yeast strains.
Which one did you say?
Wild Turkey Rare Breed.
That what got the best sipping bourbon.
Yeah, that's that makes sense.
What about the best bourbon for an old fashioned? If you were going to get your house for an old fashioned, what would you make? And then what do you think the world makes or like the most popular?
So Nicole makes old fashions at our house. She likes cocktails. I usually drink my bourbon neat, or maybe every now and then on the rocks. But, I would guess, now I'm trying to figure, Old Forester 100 proof.
Old Forester is in here. It got the best value bourbon.
Okay. Yeah.
The best bourbon for an old fashioned, they say is Maker's Mark, which is my favorite bourbon, by the way.
Yeah, that's not a bad one. Maker's Mark is another one of those that they've got a good value to it. It's a wheated bourbon, so it's sweeter. And so that makes sense in an old fashioned. I would lean more towards a straight bourbon that's got the traditional rye as the flavor. But yeah.
Maker's always feel like that's what I would drink before I would sing on tour or whatever. I'd get our tour that's manager healthy. To get me. Yeah.
Let me warm up the vocal cords.
That's what I kept telling my liver. This is healthy. We're trying to make money here, motherfucker. Good God. But
so if you like Maker's Mark, they have a Maker's 46 but it's a cask strength version of it, so it's a higher proof. That's I own two Maker's bottles right now in my collection, and one of them is that, and the other one is they did a wood finishing series from 2021 that I liked quite a bit.
Wow.
But that Maker's Cask Tree 46 is really, really good. And it's like, you can get it for like $60.
Wow. So what do you think the overall best bourbon of 2021 would be?
I'm pretty sure I read this article. So I read a lot of articles.
Okay.
So I'm trying to remember what it was. The best bourbon overall.
I've had this once or twice from a friend.
Once or twice from a friend.
Yeah.
Now I have no idea. I can't think of something that I'd be like, man, that's the best one.
Happy Van Winkle's.
Well, that's just not even fair because like most people aren't going to get that.
Right. Right.
And so I would have said that because that's generally where people go, but it's like super rare. I don't own any, I don't chase it down or anything like that. Most people pay an insane amount of money for it. Not me.
Really?
Oh yeah. It goes for an insane amount of money. There's a whole underbelly, dark side of bourbon. It's secondary markets on all of that stuff. It goes for a pretty penny.
Our buddy Luke, he was on the podcast years ago, but he has not a huge collection, but he's a bourbon guy. And he was like, this Pappy Van Winkle is awesome. And I tried it. I was like, wow, I really could. Because, I mean, when I first started drinking, all whiskey was exactly the same. Horrible.
Yeah. That's one of the things I enjoy about it, and part of the collecting and everything is that most people, their experiences, they drank too much Jack Daniels in college, and that's all they attribute it to. And so it's like, hey, actually, if you're like cool with it, like just drink a little bit of it, sip on it a little bit. I can help you find the bourbon that you really like. Interestingly enough, the first time I ever had Pappy Van Winkle or anything special like that, I still say is my biggest bourbon influence was Kevin Ming. Kevin, when we met up at the BC Con in Nashville, he brought me samples of all the Pappies to try. And so that on the way home from the con, whenever we ran our car into a tree that night, we sipped on the 23 Pappy Van Winkle sample that he gave us in the hotel room while we were eating pizza and nursing bruised ribs.
God, I remember that after the first con. I remember just hearing about the wreck y'all were talking about and how would you get home, all of that stuff. I didn't know that Kevin had gave you some whiskey, so you were able to drink some. At least that was good.
So he gave me all of the Pappies and a couple of the Buffalo Trace antique collection, which is it's along the same line, super hard to get. I actually do own some of that. He gave me that, and the only one that got damaged was the most expensive one. The lid cracked on the 23-year-old one, and a little bit of it leaked out. But the rest of them were fine, and they were in the back seat of the car. Like it was, right. It was weird. So it's just like it just got slammed around a little bit. So, but yeah, that whole experience was crazy because we got picked up in Murfreesboro and taken to Chattanooga by a BC Club member, and then Matt Tyree Then Kyle Klemichin and his wife drove us from Chattanooga to Florida to get home. So like, it was just like, we didn't have to plan anything. Like everybody was like, hey, yeah, we can help.
That's crazy. So before we get off bourbon, so what is your favorite Okay. So there's like super special occasion. This is going to be good bourbon. And then what's the go-to? Like, it's Thursday night. I just want to sit on the porch and drink a little bit of bourbon.
Being a connoisseur, most people always ask me that. Hey, what's your favorite bourbon? And it's Wild Turkey 101.
Really?
Yeah. Because it's super cheap. You can find it anywhere. And I like the taste of it.
I got so fucked up on Wild Turkey one time, but I don't think it was the 101. I don't know. It was the cheap. But is that cheap, affordable? Or is there only one Wild Turkey? Or is there a different?
They have a couple different ones. They have lower proof ones. Actually, Wild Turkey is unique because their flagship brand is the 101 proof. Like that's what they wanted it at. And it's what it goes around. Most other companies kind of build around the lower proof stuff to kind of make it more approachable. But the 101 is what Wild Turkey wants.
Wow.
And so I've got some older ones. I've got I'd say at least a quarter of my collection is Wild Turkey products that I've collected over the last several years.
And the taste is good for you. What is it? Smooth? Yeah. Is it burned? What is it?
It's got a high rye mash bill. So it's got a little bit of a spice to it. And so the rye is a spicy flavor. And then, I just like the mash bill and the age on it and everything like that. It's a decent, the portfolio or the profile that they put together for it is a solid profile for it. Most bourbons are now right now made around the flavor profile rather than like the aging and all of that stuff. And so I just like it. They've made it close to the same for the entire time they've made Wild Turkey. They've with a few little tweaks here and there, but overall it's pretty consistent.
So what does that mean? Like aging doesn't matter as much now compared to flavor. What do you mean by that?
So in the past they would be released around it. Wild Turkey 101 used to be an 8-year bourbon, and they dropped the age statement from that several years ago to build a profile that it's still around 8 years, but it's not like it to be able to say that it's an 8-year bourbon, like on the label, it has to, the youngest bourbon has to be listed. So it has to be at least 8 years. And so this lets them go into maybe a 6-year-old stock instead of an 8-year-old. They can vary it from place to place that tastes, so they can pick what barrels taste like, what they want it to taste like right now, and not necessarily be stuck with that parameter. Now, I think a lot of it is garbage because they're dropping the age statements to maximize the efficiency and the yield that they get from the barrels. And so it's more of a profit driven thing. And that's kind of changing. It's already starting on the craft distilleries. They're starting to get more into like the quality and focusing on the quality again, which is why bourbon was the way it was because it was high quality bourbon and a relatively good price.
Right. I heard this probably even a couple of years ago, there was almost like a shortage of bourbon. That's why they were going to have to start putting stuff out earlier because they couldn't keep up with the consumption of it.
Well, so bourbon almost died off completely in the 80s. There's some really cool documentaries out there. One of them is called Neat. You can see it on Hulu and Netflix. It rotates through all of the streaming services. It talks about the history. There's a couple other ones. That one's the one that it's most approachable. It's just more narrative based. It's really good. But it almost died off in the 80s or the late 70s or 80s as people went to like vodka and stuff like that. Yeah. And so it got popular, started like probably 10 years ago, it started coming back around, and then it got really, really popular in the last 5 years. And so it was moving, they couldn't get it out fast enough. And so that's the shortage was that just, it went from, since they have to age the product, they have to kind of guess what the market's going to be like for the next 5, 10, 15 years while they're making this stuff every year. Yeah. And they just weren't. So now everybody's spending like billions of dollars to expand their production and everything like that.
Wow. It's so wild. It almost reminds me of like the vinyl record industry. Like it all of a sudden makes a resurgence. And now like for us to like our new record, it takes 6 months now to get your vinyl in because it's so far backed up and all of that stuff.
I saw the other day that they were saying that it's up to a year now. If you haven't put your order in, it's going to be a year before you see your vinyl.
Yeah, it's getting insane. The number one thing you think is, oh, I got to get in the vinyl business. but the machines are like they're like $100,000+ each to start. So.
Oh, yeah. And it makes sense. Like you'd be like, oh, yeah, we should go for that. But it's like, no, it's going to continue on, but it's going to like go back down to normal. But everybody's just repressing all the stuff that they've put out that they didn't put on vinyl. Yeah. So like that's kind of a big part of the push right now.
Yeah, 100%.
The same thing with cassettes are the next thing. Everybody's pushing out cassettes and stuff. And so Paul McCartney
We just started talking about that. Maybe we should do a cassette because it seems kind of fun.
I don't know if I'd go in and maybe do like a limited, if you could get somebody to produce a small amount and like do it like an exclusive thing, like a package deal, I'd do that. But like, I wouldn't go crazy on it because, it's like, you don't know how it's going to react. And so it's like, I would play it safe.
Oh yeah. We probably will.
But you guys are pretty smart about that.
Yeah. We just thought that exactly. You're thinking the right way. That's what we were thinking. Some kind of exclusive. That'd be kind of fun. You'd want to keep a hold of it. Maybe you do have an old tape player in your old car or somewhere, you know, an old record player, tape player deal or something like that. But okay. Before we leave bourbon, because I think there's a lot of people that are interested in it and they want to drink it the right way or enjoy it the right way. But so like Wild Turkey 101, how much does that cost somebody? If they like, hey, I just want to, hey, David's talking about that. Let me go get a bottle.
I think it's usually around 30 bucks.
Oh, 20, that's not bucks. Bad at all.
I buy the big ass bottle and I have a decanter that I put it in. So it's a little cheaper, 1.75 milliliters of it. And that's like roughly 2.5 bottles of like 750 milliliters. So you can usually get that 40 to 50 bucks. Don't do that if you haven't tried Wild Turkey, if you don't like it. I know I like it, so I keep it in stock. But yeah, it's like 30 bucks, like 20, 30 bucks.
What do you think the easiest entry point for somebody that doesn't really know anything about whiskey, if they were going to go, hey, I want to try a decent whiskey and see what it's all about?
So I always tell everybody to start with bonded whiskey. That Evan Williams bottled and bond wouldn't be a bad one. And the reason why I say that is because one of the biggest things you got to look for is what flavor profile you like. What, like, you know, do I like a more corn flavor? Do I, you know, that means it has a higher percentage of corn in it. Or do I like the rye? What, you know, what do I like? And so I always say, if you can do the bonded, you're going to taste exactly what that whiskey was intended to be, because they can't do anything to it. They can't like do any tricks with it. It's got to be distilled in one, you know, like in a specific time. It's all together. It's like that. That's the best presentation they can put for that in general. And so you'll know pretty quick whether or not you like what they're going to do, and you can venture around from there. I always, if you go out to most restaurants and everything like that, everybody's kind of gotten into bourbon. You can find a place, hopefully nearby, that has, you can go just try a bottle. Like, go talk to the bartender and say, hey, I'm interested in getting whiskey. What would you have me try? You can find out real quick if that's a good bartender or not too. but yeah, it's like the bonded whiskeys are always a good place. I'm trying to think of what I would say. Most people like a lower proof, like 90 proof, 80, 90 proof. It's a place to start. Basil Hayden is put out by Jim Beam.
Yeah.
It's relatively cheap overall. You can find it everywhere. It's like 80 proof. So it's like, if you can't stand at that low of proof, like if you can't, like it's not good for you, or you don't like it, then you're probably not going to like anything that's 90 proof and not anything that's 100 proof. I drink stuff that's like 120 proof, 130 proof pretty regularly.
Oh, wow.
So like that, don't start there.
That just has to burn or be strong, right?
It definitely burns at first. The first drink is always fire. But then after that, your nose is completely burned out and your esophagus is on fire. And it's like, hey, it's smooth. It tastes good.
That's good. Yeah. The ones I go to, obviously, I love Maker's Mark. And then Josh, our keyboard player, got me turned on to Woodford Reserve.
Yeah.
I actually really enjoyed that one too. So I still don't know the difference. Like, I feel like there's Kentucky bourbon and then other bourbons. Is that right?
Well, so most bourbon is from Kentucky just because the the production and everything.
Is that the birthplace of it too, or?
Basically, yeah. There's a lot of discussion around that because historically, you know, but like generally, like it is most bourbon is coming from Kentucky. Now, it doesn't have to be from Kentucky to be called bourbon. It has to meet the bourbon requirements, which is there's a federal law about what is bourbon and all that. That's where the Bottled and Bond Act came from. That's why they say it's bonded and all that stuff. But like, it doesn't have to. So like, there's some good, like it's especially more recently as it's gotten popular all over the country, there's people producing stuff. One of the best, sourced whiskeys, like people, a lot of brands, when a brand starts, they don't typically have a 10-year bourbon. So they'll go buy it from somebody else that has a 10-year that they're doing out. MGP is like the top, company for that. And they're in Indiana, and so like they're producing and they're sourcing from like getting ingredients and stuff from Kentucky. They're doing all kinds of stuff, but like, right. I think I'm saying that right. I may be saying that wrong now that I'm thinking about it. I'm pretty sure they're in Indiana though. But yeah, so like it doesn't have to be from Kentucky, but most of it is, especially because all of those distilleries are set up there and they've been there for 100 years.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. It was so strange. The first time I realized, because like I said, when I first started drinking, it was, you know, I was underage, first of all, and it was just to get drunk. But yeah, the first time I realized that I could tell the difference between alcohol was, it was probably something like I went from Busch to Coors Light. And I was like, oh, Coors Light's a little bit better. But the first time liquor, I remember going, I like personally Jim Beam better than I do Jack Daniels. Mm-hmm. I don't know why. Whatever the reason, the taste of Jim Beam to me, but everybody else that I've ever talked to thinks they're almost exactly the same. It's the same as Coors Light and Bud Light or Miller Light. They're the same to them. But to me, there is a hint of a taste difference.
Well, you have a sophisticated palate. Those are two different. One is a Tennessee whiskey and the other one is a Kentucky bourbon. So they're made differently and all of that stuff that generally and how they're filtered and all of that stuff. It's different. But so you're not off. Like you're definitely like recognizing that those are two different things, two different products.
Yeah.
That fall in the same family overall. It's the difference from stout and ale. Like it's different beers.
Right. Right. Totally. Which one is the Tennessee whiskey or the
Jack Kentucky? Daniels?
Jack Daniels is Tennessee, Jim Beam is Kentucky.
Oh, and they will let you know on their label. You can look on the label and you'll know.
I should have known that. I lived in Tennessee and I remember Jack Daniels was in a little bit south of me. I never went and toured it, but
we toured it when we came up to Nashville.
Oh, really?
Yeah. On the way up, we came from Florida and we stopped on the way there. We couldn't really do a whole lot of anything. We had our dog with us, and so she got to go in the gift shop with us.
And then you guys were in Florida and you moved to Arkansas, you're from Arkansas, went to Florida for a while. Now you're back in Arkansas.
Yeah. Moved, April of last year, we moved back to Arkansas.
And you just wanted to get back close to family or miss the Arkansas, tired of Florida or what?
We always planned on moving back at some point and it just made sense. We found out that our house was worth a lot more than we thought it was worth.
Oh, really?
And so we started talking about, you know, what do we do? And so it was like, do we buy a new house in Florida? We take the time to move back to Arkansas. And it just made sense on a lot of fronts to move back. All of our families here and everything. And so both of us working from home made it easy to transition and everything. And so it was time to come back. And so since we've been back, Nicole's grandpa's passed away. One of my grandpa's has passed away. And so it's like, it's a good time to be back, like to be able to be able to, and all that stuff. And so we've had different things happen. It's been good for us to be back. With everything. And so the weird thing is that we've been back and we're still kind of like getting used to everything because we moved from in the middle of moving from Florida, we were at like stay at home orders in Florida. We moved to Arkansas and that wasn't the case. And then everything shut down after that. And so it's like, we still are getting like settled into the community because like we haven't been able to do much of anything overall. It's been opening up, but like, now we've got the Delta variant coming in and it's like we are the hot, like literally I've seen it on the news like every day. They're talking about Arkansas being like the like hot spot for
Delta
for everything because a lot of people wouldn't go get vaccinated. We got vaccinated, but a lot of people haven't. And so it's just kind of spreading here. And now people are starting to get vaccinated because they're like, oh, like I should probably do this. So this is going to be an ongoing thing. But it's still, we're seeing a spike. So,
yeah, it's that is so crazy. I just talked to my dad this weekend and he's 69 years old. He's in good health. So even if he got COVID, I'm not really worried about him dying or whatever. But at the same time, I was like, you never know. This is the first misinformation stuff that I was like, oh, okay, come on. He goes, I've heard, Toby, that there's some rumblings about this being the mark of the beast. And I was like, oh man, I haven't heard that in so long. This is crazy. Like these things. And I was like, what do I say to my dad right now? Cause my dad already thinks I'm a raging liberal that mm-hmm. just, you know, just every possible thing, you know,
steer into the skid, man.
Right. So I said, Dad, I said, that is a bunch of nonsense. I said, the mark of the beast. I said, that wouldn't be it. I said, that thing in your hand right now that you're talking to me on, if there was a mark of the beast, it would be that. You don't ever go anywhere without that. It has all your information. You tell it anything. It knows you better than anybody else on earth almost. I said, that would be it. And he goes, I don't know. I'll tell you what, I injected myself with anything. Or so, you know, and I was like, okay. Well, I said, that's fine. But, you know, when you do get COVID, you're going to be really scared. You know, and no matter what, the data is showing that if you have a vaccine, that COVID will be, it might still be shitty, but you have a humongous chance of not dying or being real, you know, really in danger. And he waves me off.
We actually debated on whether or not we were going to get vaccinated just because generally we weren't around a whole lot of people. And it was like, it was on the downward swing. And it's like, if it gets to a certain point, like we don't necessarily need to. And then we ultimately decided to do it just because it was like, let's go ahead and get it done. And for generally that same reason. And so, it's just kind of a weird spot. Also, if they start injecting it in like your forehead and like leaving a mark on your hand, maybe, but like until then, like, I'm going to go with the credit card theory on the mark of the beast.
Right. And it seems like if they were that smart, the devil's that smart, he would have just slid it in the polio vaccine or something. You know what I mean? Yeah. Like, you know what I mean? Like the one that everybody takes no matter what.
We're marked already. Like it's done.
Oh, right? Yeah. You're done. If the devil's got you almost no matter what. But I will say this. I sympathize with a lot of anti-vaxxer people, especially because I follow sports a lot. And there's a lot of people in sports that don't want to take, especially in the NFL. But so I waited a long time too, because I was like, I don't know if there's a big hurry. I also work from home. My kids aren't getting the vaccine. And now my wife even works at a hospital, but the health precautions they take, I mean, they, you know, some COVID rooms and stuff, she wears full suits to go into and all this stuff. And she was just like, I just want to wait a little bit. I'm not opposed to taking it, but I just want to wait. Just a little.
And exactly where we were.
Yeah. And I just thought that I don't think that's bad, or you're not killing people. Let me take a moment just to see what this is. Let me think about it and do it for the right reasons, as opposed to out of fear or just because everybody's doing it or whatever it might be. So that was the same way. But all right, I only got a few more minutes here because Monica Potluck's coming on.
Okay.
But I want to talk to you about RIFO in the pandemic. What was that like?
Well, so when you're mostly known as a network of host homes for bands to stay when they're out on the road and everything shuts down, it gets quiet pretty quick. So we quickly found ourselves, we actually pretty quickly, like early on, I think like February, we were like, hey, like with our host homes, we were like, you don't have to do anything you don't want to do. Like, we didn't stop it. We let them do, especially because it was still like we were learning what was going on. So we were like, hey, like if you don't feel comfortable, like do whatever you want. And we carry that same thing now. Like if you don't want to host right now, don't do that. The interesting thing is we were on a trajectory to not move past that, but add on to that and do more. And so it kind of let us focus on like what do we in the big picture of everything, like the serving that way, hosting bands and everything like that is part of what we want to do, but it's not the 100% thing. So what do we want to do? So we built out some different things that we could do that were basically like, hey, how are you doing? Like a timeline activity of like, let's assess where you're at right now. That we started doing those things like that and just getting people having conversations, talking about that. Like we called it turning points. And so it really was like, we were in a unique spot and we talked about this. We're like, usually with everybody, like it's individual. And so like everybody has different turning points and all of that stuff. Yeah. But like, we're all in one right now. So like, let's keep that in mind. Let's talk through that. And then just kind of like being available like that. And so we, in the middle of all of that, we started talking so we're actually part of a missions organization. So like RIFO is under a global missions organization. And so ultimately we're talking about like from a mission standpoint. And so we also started working with Tampa Underground, which is a micro church network. And so we basically started looking for how do we grow the serving and all of that stuff, all the stuff that we want to see happen. How do we do that? Because it's not going to work with just three of us. Like, we can't be that doing that. And so we started looking for people that want to serve, and it's like resourcing them. And so we kind of shifted into the idea of like, hey, what if we built community around the idea of like gathering local people that want to serve musicians and saying, hey, what if you just like did that?
Yeah. Right. Right. I think the big thing that is that I saw with COVID that is going to be great. Well, okay, two things. One, the digital experience is going to be important now. But like we've done a few digital specials. We got one with our second album coming out on August 12th, I think. And
my birthday.
Nice. And so I think that's going to be important. But what that is going to do is increase the experience of live. And that's going to be really valuable. So when you see a band live, because I think the digital experience is going to get better and better and better, where you're like, oh, I can see my favorite band, or, oh man, I love this song, I'm going to see it tonight from the comfort of my couch or whatever. But 6 months from now, they are going to be in your town that one time that year, or one time that 2 years, or something. You know what I mean? Like, bands are going to tour less, and it's going to be more valuable to you. You're going, oh man, this is going to be really worth it. We're going to make a real event of it and something like that. Then the other thing will be, which I think could coincide with RIFO, is I think the house shows are going to explode. I think being in somebody's backyard or something like that is going to be really amazing.
We actually have partnered with Renew the Arts, Justice Stout, who was actually involved. We met him at the second BCCon in Dallas. He was part of the team that was working on the documentary.
Yep.
So they've launched a thing that's a house church, or not a house church, a house show network. That they're doing that, like people that want to do house shows. And so they've got like 150 houses right now, I think, that have signed up all over the country.
Oh, wow.
And we're actually signed up to do it too. So like we're part of that. Me and Nicole, we're actually hosting our first house show, on the 22nd of August. And so, we do see a lot of benefit in that. But the thing about it is, and this is kind of where it's going, is like, hey, that's their 100% thing. So like, if you want to just do that, like, this is a better fit for you to go over there and join them. We'd still love to work together. And overall, if you understand what we're working on, but like, know that like, we're not going to be like putting all of our focus and effort and everything into making making that happen. Like, it's just part of what we're doing. And so we want to see it grow, but like that they're focused in on that. So it's like, hey, check that out. It's a good way to go. And so we definitely, I mean, the house show stuff has been growing for a while. And I think with all of this, another side of that is that a lot of venues shut down because they couldn't be open.
Right.
And they were barely holding on as it was. And so, they've had to shift to a lot of stuff. And so it's just kind of, there will be new venues opening up, and the ones that were able to make it because they had other ways of doing it, like they'll it'll take a whole new investment into that to be able to see those come around. And this is a more intimate way to do it. And I know people that their whole living is just doing house shows. Like, they don't even play, like they don't even try to get, like into venues and stuff like that. They make more money because they can go and see where their audiences are and go book a house show there and get that audience there. So,
right. That pairing is kind of cool too, because you guys, I mean, eventually it'll be somebody will let you play at their house and you could even stay there and they can take, that kind of thing.
One of the things that Porchlight does is they ask like, hey, would you be willing to host the band too? And so it's like, it's a natural conversation. Most of the people that are going to do that are probably going to be that. I don't see maybe some of them, but like generally it's like, if they're opening up their home to have the house show, they're probably able to host the band too.
Yeah.
And so it's just kind of like, okay, well, we have a lot of experience. We'd love to be in the conversation to talk about, what we've experienced over the last 10 years.
Right.
Totally. The other part of that, that's not really, it's kind of coming out there, is I actually took over for RIFO. I'm the director of RIFO now. I was just handling the administrative stuff. And so 2020 was a rough year for a lot of transition. And one of them was that my supervisor, Simeon, he actually stepped up into a new leadership position. He took a 6-month sabbatical at the beginning of the year, and he's coming back on now in this new leadership position. And so I've taken over. So I'm handling, I the way that I've been describing it to people is I am both the Jim Halpert and the Michael Scott of RIFO right now.
Wow. That's wild. So a lot of juggling a lot of balls there, man. My God, that's crazy. Yeah. I didn't know you were the director.
Yeah. So it'd been, we had been doing it for a year or for since the beginning of the year. I was the interim with the idea that we had been talking about it. Like, we're just going to, at some point, we'll just drop that interim title. But I was like, I've been operating as a director with like the full responsibility and decision making and all of that stuff since the beginning of the year. We had kind of been positioning that. And so it's official now. My title updates a little bit, but not a whole lot. And now I have to do a lot more fundraising because I have a lot more responsibility. And so I don't have the ability, the same availability that I had previous to this. So I've got to do that. So I'm stepping into it and rolling all that stuff out right now. But it's also, I get to connect with a lot of people in a different way, and kind of part of it was managing this transition into what we're doing going forward with the micro church stuff. And so that's what I've been handling. And so we're getting ready to start communicating that out a lot more with a lot of people. So,
oh, nice, dude. Well, sorry, I'm running out of time here. I gotta get Michael on here, but let's come back on, fill out the form again, or tell me, and we'll just so I know that you're there, and we'll have you back on in a few months or something like that, and talk about it more. Where can people find out more about RIFO though, if they want?
We've got a terribly out of date website that I just haven't touched in the last year. RIFO.org, RYFO.org. Message me directly, David Hamilton. I'm pretty accessible. I'm on my phone all the time. It's kind of annoying sometimes, but I'm always willing to answer any and all questions and get people pointed in the right direction and all that stuff. We do have all the social media stuff. We're not really too worried about that right now.
Right.
We've been just been trying to figure out who we're going to be for the next 5 years. So we've got all that, but yeah, I mean, we've got all that stuff, and I'm managing all of it. So if you send a message somewhere that it has RIFO in the name of it, it's probably coming to me.
All right, dude. Well, it was good catching up, man. Thanks for all the information. You and Kevin Mean got to do a bourbon podcast then.
I mean, So we had talked a bunch about doing a bourbon thing at the Kansas City Con. We were talking about the possibility of doing something like that. So at some point we'll have to do something fun. I think if I remember correctly, Kevin's kind of said he's getting out of bourbon a little bit.
Oh, right.
I want to say that he was just in general, he's kind of like, I don't know that I maybe making that up, but I'm pretty sure he was like chilling out a little bit on it. I'm still knee deep in the obsession of collecting and drinking and everything. I'd love to share it. So that's a big part for me. It's like just having people over and trying stuff. So I always like to help people find the bourbon that they like.
I love that. All right, Dave. It was good talking to you, man. I'll talk to you later.
All right. Later.